All of us here at the PWO Place to Be Nation were saddened to hear of the passing of Adam Cech after a valiant fight against cancer. Adam had been a member of our little community for some time, and he will be missed. He leaves behind a loving wife and two young sons, and our love and condolences go out to them and all of his family and friends. During his battle, Adam had said that listening to the podcasts on the feed helped him get through some of those tough times during his fight. So we'd like to ask everyone out there to help lend a hand to his family. A GoFundMe page has been established for future educational expenses for his boys and to fulfill his plans for the boys to see a Packers game at Lambeau Field. Whatever you can donate will be greatly appreciated and will be put towards helping this young family navigate a future without Adam. Just head over to GoFundMe.com and put in Adam's Pack - helping Adam's family in the search engine, and please give what you can. Thank you.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
From Space City, USA, Paul Bosch presents Wrestling Spectacular, matching the world's top wrestlers in fierce competition.
Welcome to This Week in Wrestling, NWA On Demand. I'm Pete, and I'm with the Sheedy-nominated Johnny Cesaro. Johnny, how's the voice going, and how are you?
Oh, everything is going just dandy. It's been a lovely weekend here in Colorado. It's finally cold and snowy, which is refreshing.
Yeah, it's just been rainy and cold in Texas. Not enough to really affect anything, but definitely wearing a jacket and stuff like that. Rogue One is upon us. I have my tickets for Thursday night for my Rogue One viewing. I'm looking forward to that. Are you looking forward to the new Star Wars movie?
I totally forgot it was coming out. So no, it looks good. I'm not like, I was like, yeah, it doesn't come out in December sometime. You know, let me put it this way. I was not a big fan of Force Awakens, but this looks good.
My sources said, and they loved the Force Awakens. They said they went to a screener, and they said they enjoyed this more than Force Awakens. So, and they said it really expanded more of the mythology of Star Wars and stuff because this goes right into, Star Wars. I mean, that's what the basic premise is. But
yeah.
Hey.
Oh yeah, no, yeah. It, I'm willing to give it a shot. I'll probably end up getting dragged to it. You know, for the midnight, the midnight premiere viewing by my roommates, because that's what happened with Force Awakens. I was even like, I'm getting a little too old to go to a movie at midnight, and they're like, no, you have to, Star Wars. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, I don't know how it works. They say it starts on Friday, but somehow I have a ticket for Thursday at 10-something, so who knows. I think the earliest was Thursday at like 6 or 8 o'clock, and I have to work till 8, so me and my boys are going to go to dinner and then to the movie. But hey, let's get on to NWA On Demand, and we open up with a... we have a couple matches. I'm going to group them together. We got these Nick Bockwinkel squash matches, and pretty much what they do back in the day in any territory, because Bockwinkel wasn't featured regularly on Houston television, even though he owned a piece of the territory or the arena. He would they would show him because he wasn't on part of the regular TV. This would happen everywhere, where they'd send in a couple squash matches like to get them ready, or video packages in here, because this is definitely two squashes that took place in the AWA, and they were here just kind of like to feature them, to show them. And I kind of like, I always refer to squash matches as kind of like a boxer when they're sparring. You know, it's there to highlight, and if you ever had like boxing, you know, they used to have sparring, and they'd have the like a media there, and it was pretty much there to highlight the star, which is here, Nick Bockwinkel, and the squash matches are the point of the squash matches to get the star even more over than he already was, or to feature him or make him look good. And that's exactly what both these guys got. Jake Milliman is like a famous journeyman wrestler. I mean, he was been around even on the dying days of the AWA. He was part of that Team Challenger series where he got his big push of his lifetime, and we also have a guy named Torpedo Guzman here, who that's a character's name, and he actually looked like a pretty good hand, who actually looked like he had a little gimmick going where he might have worked in the Southwest at some point underneath, but both of them are, you know, entertaining squashes and did their goal of getting Bockwinkel over. You know, they didn't have any bells or whistles on it, but it's always neat to and yeah, I'm assuming these are both taped on the same day, since Bobby the Brain is wearing the same exact suit, and it's not just like a weasel suit like he used to wear in the WWF. This is just a regular suit he'd wear.
There's nothing regular about this suit. The suit rules.
Okay, you know, it's very nice. But anything you have to add to these things?
Well, yeah, I guess Torpedo Guzman's gimmick was Frito Bandito. He had a big stereotypical sombrero on. It didn't match the rest of his outfit.
Yeah, he kind of looked like a fatter Silver King.
And the announcer, this is for what, Rogers Kent? Is that his name?
Yeah.
Kent. I love him. I guess I haven't really been exposed to enough of him. He is just smooth. That's another guy who got his start, I'm sure, in the golden age of television, doing lots of different things, and eventually did wrestling, I'm assuming, because he's got that type of voice of those. And those guys, I mean, that's how Gordon Sully was one of those guys, and Dave Brown, you know, and Lance Russell, all those guys came from old news, and those guys are the best. And he's so good here. Lovely to listen to. I said he sounds like the announcer from The Joker's Wild, the old game show.
I remember it. I remember The Joker's
Wild. Yeah, I remember The Joker's Wild. The Joker's Wild.
I used to love that. It was one of my all-time favorite game shows. By the way, too.
And they mentioned, you know, wrestling's a rough business. Jake Milliman was young, and he didn't have skinny arms. That was odd. He looked like a little Anderson.
And he had blonde hair here. I never remembered him with blonde hair. Maybe he always had it. I always thought he had like darkish grayish hair, but I might be wrong.
Rogers had a great line about learning drop toe. Oh, we learned how to do drop toe holds in the Marines, and it's far easier if the person is running towards you to put on this whole. And I thought that was hilarious. I'm picturing Marines in boot camp practicing
drop toe holds. Yeah,
drop toe holds. That's how we're gonna get Charlie.
Yeah, I know, right?
That drop toe hold stinks.
You know, that's always been like the rule of hand-to-hand combat is when you're in a fight with more than one person, you never take it to the ground because you're exposing yourself, and here you are doing drop toe holds in the middle of a battle.
They cut that part out of the drill sergeant basic training stuff from Full Metal Jacket. I would have loved to have seen that. Private Pyle, that's the worst drop toe hold I've ever seen. But to your point about what Heenan has, this is the 70s, brother, and Heenan is disco styling.
Oh, yeah.
It's not extravagant with all the, you know, the glitter and stuff. He is, like, wearing what stylish men of that time wore, you know, and it just gave him a real air of authenticity as a manager, as did, as you mentioned, that interaction. Like, we're here to put on a little thing, you know, for the press, like you said, because they do the best thing. Bockwinkel hits some move with ease and kind of jogs over to Heenan.
Yes.
Do a high five, hand slap. And he's like, ah. And it's so obnoxious, but so entertaining. And it totally speaks to what you're saying.
Okay.
Amazing.
What I popped the most for was when he actually went to the corner and Bobby gave him a sweat towel to wipe off with. And he goes back to the match. I thought, that was freaking fantastic. Amazing. After that AWA set came out in whatever, that was like probably 2 or 3 years ago now, the Death Valley Drivers, I really, really learned to appreciate Bockwinkle, and I'm really, I consider him one that, on my greatest wrestler ever ballot, I had him as number, I think number four on my ballot, maybe five, but I think I had him four. And the guy is so smooth, and he's really, even here on the Houston, I mean, these are squash matches, but what we've seen so far on the Houston footage, he's pretty damn great, you know?
Oh, yeah. And what I think all this newfound footage has shown, because I was familiar with a lot of Bockwinkle. I saw Bockwinkle live a bunch at the end of his career. And we've seen a lot of footage. What we haven't gotten to see a lot of is prime Heenan and Bockwinkle as a team. And seeing this, it's just like, just they're perfect together. We've seen the promos, but like in-ring little stuff like this, the hand slap, the towel, and everything. And it's just like, these are a perfect combination. And I really want to see more of them.
Yeah, from the little I've seen of them, I really think they're my favorite 1-2 punch, manager, wrestler punch of all
they've
time.
They gotta be up there, yeah.
Yeah. And I was looking over the book Parv has it, so I'm going to steal out of his wheelhouse, is the Heels book by Greg Oliver and Steven Johnson. And they list Bockwinkle as the 13th best heel of all time. Do you think that's a fair ranking? I mean, I know, not to put you on the spot. I mean, I know it was not like we'd prepped this or anything.
You son of a bitch, you and your ambush questions.
Damn straight.
Your gotcha questions or your shoddy journalism. Let's see, 13 of all time. I could say it.
Yeah, I totally
could. I could totally say it. You know, that sounds about right.
Yeah, it worked on top that's, for a long time.
Yeah, I mean it's funny. Like I got to see him do a lot of the typical AWA end of your career babyface run.
Yeah.
That was the tradition in the NWA, the AWA. You know, he got one. Crusher got one. Baron von Ra- you know, one after another. At the end of the careers, they all get to be babyfaces, and I got to see that. You know. And it was fun, but the more we see him as a heel, he's just like, he's fantastic. He's not a cackling villain. You know, he's just a very intelligent athlete.
Yeah, when he's picking on intelligence, I'm looking here, and they have a quote from Bockwinkle in the book that he's like pretty much they're saying how he's one of the most articulate heels of all time. And he had a secret weapon during his heyday. And for those familiar with those, with his eloquent discourses on the state of the world during interviews, it wouldn't surprise. It was a dictionary. actually, it wasn't one dictionary, but many. He had a little notebook in which he jotted down interesting words and began to learn them and their meaning. And here's the quote was, "I used to use 4 or 5 or 6 syllable words as best I could," expounded Bockwinkle. "And if I ran across one I didn't know, I had a little dictionary. I would have this little dictionary with 70 or 80 words that I would always have be pursuing. I had it with me all the time. Automatically, some of these words just started coming to me in my interviews because I was familiar with them." And, I mean, that's too much what he was. He was this guy. I remember hearing Heenan interviews where talking to him, you know, you'd ask what time it was, and he'd tell you how to build the watch.
Right.
Which I always thought that was a fantastic line. And then here...
Heenan also once said, he was like, during those interviews, like, after the camera and stuff, he'd, like, look over at Bockwinkle and he's like, "I don't have any idea what the fuck you just said."
Yeah. And, like, here Lance Russell praises his arrogance and condensation of Tricky Nick. He made it a point to let that come across, and he played that so beautifully. Nose in the air, smelling something bad, you lowly peons. Nick had that down to a T. The guy could wrestle. Larry Henning described both sides of Bockwinkle as articulate and meticulous. And it really is true, and you really see it in his promos about the arrogance. And it wasn't like this put-on arrogance, but he just had it where it was just grating as a heel, and he could really get under your skin, and I thought he did it fantastically.
Mm-hmm.
But let's move over to our next match, which is the Spoiler versus Frank Dusik. And in the Heels book here, the Spoiler just barely etched out of the top 25 heels of all time. And I'm gonna read a little bit of it here. It's a backward compliment that you can only work in the twisted world of professional wrestling. Donald was made to wear the mask, Gary Hart certainly doesn't mean anything well mean about it. He simply feels that when Don Jardine put on a mask in 1967 and became the Spoiler under his stewardship, he changed who he was and became a major superstar. He was one of those guys that didn't have a whole lot of personality in his face, but was an extremely good worker, continued Hart. Once he put on the mask, he was off and running. All Don really needed was some packaging and some direction. And Jardine occurred and explained how he changed with his face hidden. I think your body takes over when the movements from your arms and legs and everything else, your face doesn't necessarily do everything. He said, if the people are 300, 400 feet up, they currently can't see the emotion on your face, but they can certainly see the motion from your arms or your legs or whatever you're doing with them. A lot better than a facial expression unless you're at ringside. It was a 12-year struggle for Jardine to climb that hill to full-time main event status as a Spoiler and later as a Super Destroyer. He was born in New Brunswick in 1940 and raised in Monacan. Don and his brother Herb were big wrestling fans. Many, many times Don and I would walk down to the stadium to get in. We tried to carry the wrestler's bag, said Herb Jardine. We'd always get a way to get in. What Herb didn't know was that his brother would grow into an impressive physical specimen himself. Emile Dupre, who later trained Jardine at the local Y. Can you imagine them training at the local Y?
Yeah, I can.
Recalled seeing the youngster around town. He was a kid about 15 to 16 years old. He used to hang around Main Street, and in fact, I used to see him at the Capitol Theater. He knew what I was wrestling, and when he approached me, I was looking at his height. He was 6'4", 6'5". He's a big, tall kid, big natural, big legs, muscular legs. I told him he should work out with weights to get a big upper body, which he did. In no time at all, he blew up. I saw him that year later after that, during a charity appearance at Macon's Eden's department store. Whipper Billy Watson met Jardine and came away impressed. It's just pretty neat. I mean, he's told around in different territories in Calgary, North Bay, the Maritimes, Indianapolis, Amarillo, the American Midwest, Oregon, and down to California. And then he started wearing the mask. And first he started as this team as the Masked Enforcers team with Clyde Steves. And then in 63, Jardine made the first of 9 trips to Japan. But what all that was is a warm-up for the Spoiler. Mm. And this is where his big break came. Was Fritz Von Erich had met Jardine on the road and assured him that one day he'd own a territory and bring him in. And true to his word, Von Erich hired Jardine, gave him the Spoiler name, and Gary Hart as his manager. And Hart was the one who created the persona that he had become, that he had, because he had put on that outfit. To me, he looked like the Phantom, said Hart. That's how I envisioned him. If you remember, I said he was from Singapore to come combat the perennial babyface Von Erich in Dallas. It was decided to allow Spoiler to use a variation of the Iron Claw, the Heart Crusher, which was delivered with a black glove with the fingers cut out. And we see that glove even in the footage right now. And Donnie says, Donald wasn't your typical bad guy. What made Donald a bad guy was me being with him, said Hart. The fans always liked him. Once he put the mask on, the fans loved him. What made him dislike him was me being his manager. Hart obviously feels a lot of high, has a high opinion of himself here. And deservedly so. Jardine recognized them as well and changed his wardrobe accordingly. If you were new to a territory, if you had a reputation of drawing money, then you had to know what to say on TV and how to get yourself over in the different outfits and everything. When I started, I always wore black because black is more of a feel thing. Then later on, I stayed in a territory. My outfits got lighter and lighter because I knew eventually that people would end up liking me. I thought that was really neat. And, you know, he had a big input in Fat Pact with help train The Undertaker. And it's cool because in a lot of the footage, you see a lot of The Undertaker in the Spoiler with the walking of the ropes and this and that. But here, it's a rather bland match. And uh-huh. And you brought something up in our chat, which I thought was really interesting. Why don't you talk about that and talk about the match in general, Johnny?
Oh, well, I forgot what that was because we'll get to it. But this match I just gotta be fair. I thought this match stunk. It had nothing to do with the talent of the people in the ring. It was just come out. The fans hate both. This is booking. This is all booking decisions. Fans hate both these guys, and they just, I don't know. There's no one does anything to even try to get them behind them a little, and it just. It's not working, and it's long. It felt long, and just thought it was just dull. The crowd was dead. At one point, they do the typical Houston, please return to your seats, like as if it's people crowding it because it's a riot.
Yeah.
And that, they must have been just saying that to the people who were leaving in droves during this. No, no, please. And then you got McShane. I had to make a point of Danny McShane, the referee, because he looked awesome in his big silver mane pork chops and everything. I could picture him as like a cop in a 70s cop show solving crimes and refereeing matches. You know, McShane, fantastic. And Paul Bosch is doing everything to try to make this interesting. He, oh, God bless him. He tries. He talks about the Dusicks. I know their family.
Oh, yeah, he went through like the whole... whole genealogy in the family tree.
Yeah, but then he goes through the whole fucking family tree of the Dusicks, and Texas goes, "I know them," and he goes, "Not socially."
Yeah, we get second cousin talk and
oh shit,
cousin yeah. Once removed. Yeah, he went through the gauntlet.
It's like the best thing. He's like, "I know of their family, but believe you, they're far below us on the social scale. I'm Paul Goddamn Bosch. I own this town." Oh, man, he's trying, but he just gives up a few times, and there's more silence than I've ever heard in a Paul Bosch called match ever. Just these long moments of silence where he's kind of like, you know, he mutes his mic and goes, I give the fuck up. Okay, hold on.
What the
fuck?
Okay, go
my
on.
Point, I think my point was, it's really interesting to watch something that didn't work. You know, NWA On Demand is a, and this is going to sound like the most Johnny Logic thing in the world, by the way, but I truly mean it. Getting to see talented guys doing a match, it just don't work. It's just not working. And that's almost like we're watching this for its historical value. And to see something like that, well, oh, it didn't work here. I think it's more fun. It brings more more things to watch on the service. Instead, it's like, here's a bunch of stuff that's all amazing. You know, you need to, you know, you're looking at this from a historical perspective. This is something historical. It's like, wow, these guys were good and talented, and both were, spoiler, super over. Dusik had a name, but just for whatever reasons, it didn't work. You know, it's interesting to watch in that way, I think.
No, I totally agree. And it's kind of funny now when we go back to here, but look at Frank Dusik and probably most modern, or not even modern, most Attitude Era people might remember him mostly is from the Mick Foley book. Do you remember the quote he used?
Oh, shit.
About Cactus Jack, you'll never be a top card of the guy, but you can be a this or this, and people like you here. Why do you want to leave and stuff? Because you'll never be a top guy. And
I didn't remember that. I remember the quote, but I didn't remember who said it.
Yeah, Dusik was I don't know exactly what he was. I think he might have been the assistant, one of the book, not booker. I know Eric Embry was booking World Class, USWA at the time, and Percy Pringle was Embry's assistant booker. But they used Dusik as like the authoritarian figure. He was kind of like... He was the owner or the GM or whatever they called it back then.
Oh, right. I kind of remember that now.
Yeah, and Cactus Jack in 1989 and 90 worked, I think in 89, was working there before he went to WCW.
Right.
And he said they'll never know what to do with Cactus Jack. You'll never be a top-of-the-card guy, but you have a place here and people like you. And there was something, and there was some other thing, top of the bottom. You might be a bottom, you might be a top of the bottom guy. Ooh, thing. Ooh. and stuff. And then it always, I mean, it obviously affected Mick Foley enough to where he remembered that damn quote. It was kind of like in your face. Right. He brought it, and he remembered last, he said it's the last time he saw him, he brought it up to him. And Dusek, he said he was just turning beet red, and he goes, "Oh God, I can't remember. I believe I said that quote to you." And but look at you now. He goes, "In Cactus, I've never been more glad to be wrong in my life," which I thought was a pretty classy thing.
That's cool. Because to be completely fair to Frank Dusek, he's not the only guy who said that.
No, you're absolutely right. I never saw Money in Cactus when I first saw him. Did you?
I did.
I did it. I mean, first, I saw him in 89. I'm like, okay, this guy is a weirdo. I was Ric Flair, like, this guy will never be a world champion.
Not me at all. And I'll tell you, not to digress, to exactly what happened. This is my senior year in high school. I was not watching wrestling. I'd turn it on every now and then on a Saturday night and catch something. And I caught Cactus Jack, and they were calling him still Cactus Jack Manson.
Yeah.
And he's in the ring, and he's screaming like a maniac, and he legitimately disturbed me. And I went, oh, fuck, what's this guy all about? And he made an immediate impression on me. And when I watched back and forth, I go, where's that guy at? Like, crazy motherfucker, I loved that guy. And then he comes back, and I happen to be watching one of my little spurts when he comes back and fights with Sting and all that shit. And I was just like, boom, I was always on the Cactus Jack bandwagon.
Yeah, I never saw it. It might have been because of my footage watching back in the day early in my career was watching World Class, and I always saw the Devastation Inc. guys, and I always thought they were much more scarier and believable than, of course, I was a lot younger than Cactus Jack and stuff. But
I didn't watch any of that. My first exposure was this guy who's screaming like a stuck pig while destroying a jobber.
Right.
That was my first experience. I'm like, what the fuck? That's awesome.
But back to the match. Mm-hmm. Basically, this is your 70s styles match where we see a lot of exchanging of holds. I did enjoy the bit of arm work that Dusek did in the match. And I thought the whole entire, like, they just did it and was a very dull match. But one thing, the spoiler, and again, you got to remember the time frame. This is 1979, where they had the audience, you know, like, you'd go, and they'd go, man, that first or second match might not have been real. But my God, that third match looked real. That third match was real. The main event was real. Well, spoiler, snaps off this boot that looked so nasty and looked like it knocked Dusek's face off. And
I will say, I'm glad you brought that up because I forgot about that. And that was the one highlight of a move because I remember being like, Jesus Christ, he just kicked his fucking head off.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where they work a little, they don't want to hurt you, but every now and then they'll work a little stiffer to say, damn, that's real. And that, I think that's what the spoiler did right there, was made the audience believe in him. You know, this match, other matches might not be real, but this match is real. And I think he used this match in that moment to make that point. And I enjoyed that, that it set up at the finish. And I loved spoiler snapping Dusek's neck on the rope to follow up with the top rope forearm. So I liked the psychology of the finish. But I'm with you. It was a rather mundane, boring match, but the upside is that this took place on March, April, May, June, July, August 3rd, 1979, and hopefully, I looked at this card. They have the main event that we'll get footage of, which is Jose Lothario versus Gino Hernandez. Loser paints the other yellow.
Oh fuck yeah!
I hope to God they have that in the vault. It's worth going through this to get to that. I'll go through 10 spoiler versus Dusek match if I can get that Lothario.
I agree.
Match. Okay.
I'm totally with you. You could exactly if we got to run the gauntlet of this shit to get to that.
Yeah.
I am more than willing because that sounds amazing.
And you know, so I'll tell you one thing though. NWA Demand has not thrown a whole lot of these just crappy matches out there.
No, not at all. But like I said,
it happens. I mean, you've gone to enough live wrestling back in the 80s to know yeah, there's going to be a bunch of doggers out there. We've been lucky that Houston really hasn't put out a whole bunch of – the night service hasn't put out a whole lot of doggers. But nonetheless, it is what it is. But like God, hopefully we get that main event, that filet mignon.
Yeah, well, but it's like this again. Getting to experience it all, you know, and watch it with a discerning eye and go, oh, I wonder why this didn't work. I mean, that's what we do all the time with our podcasts anyway. So it's kind of a fun thing to have to be like, I mean, if all you get is filet mignon, you're going to get sick of filet mignon.
No, it's true. It's very true. And right at this point, we'll take a break and we'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds as well. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out on the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your...
We are back with a heck of a match with Eddie Gilbert and the Nightmares versus the Guerreros, which was one hell of a match. What did you think of it, man?
Oh, I love this. This was a ton of fun. And remind me who the Nightmare was.
Took place December 13th, 1985. He was the Nightmare. They on the listing had him as the champion, but he was one of I'm drawing a blank too.
Was it Moondog?
It was a Moondog. I just can't remember. I think it was the one who ended up trying to be Demolition. When part of Demolition
was it Randy? Too. Randy Colley.
Yep.
Okay, I guess I remember that, but I couldn't remember who. So it was Randy Colley. Dude, he's huge.
Big boy.
Jesus Christ! You're looking at him, and when you'd see him in the WWF. You know, you like where everyone's huge, you know, and see him here sitting next to Eddie Gilbert, and like, holy shit, he's a fucking monster.
Yeah,
and he can work. He's a for a guy that size, he can bump around and fucking work, dude. He's great. I do remember that when I'd be reading the PWIs even, and first start getting this like. Wait, your champion is now just some dude named The Nightmare? I thought that was lame as fuck, you know? But once you get past the name, he's awesome. So this, and you got...
And he's without the mask, or you still have
And the mask, yeah, no mask, so he's probably even better without it. You know, he looks like a big scary dude. The mask looked kind of silly on him. And you had the Guerreros, who at one point do the whole cheat to win shit, which... I'm popping for because whenever with Eddie, they go, yeah, cheat no man, it's a family tradition. I'm like, what, in a family full of baby faces? What the fuck are you talking about? And but no, they cheat here to get the pin or I think whatever, and it's awesome. Like, yeah, Guerreros are cheating no man. That's fantastic. This was so much fun. I love the description Bosch gave of the Nightmare. He's not one of these manicured, muscled athletes. Like, nope, no manicures there whatsoever. That's a big beastly dude. And this was a blast. I loved it.
That's one thing about Eddie Gilbert, which I get a kick out of, especially Mid-South, which is really where we get a lot of the footage from. I mean, everyone thinks of Eddie Gilbert. The first thing you always think of, though, is Memphis.
See, I don't. I always think of this because this was my first experience of Eddie Gilbert as a star.
Okay, but this is really the territory where we see the most of his career in ring, because they actually had matches. Most of Memphis, you know, was studio or was highlight version, so we never really get to see true Eddie. In WCW, we get a little taste of him, and in Continental, a little taste, and Smoky Mountain, all over Puerto Rico. I mean, the guy worked at freaking New York. I mean, the guy worked everywhere, but I always get a kick out of him in Mid-South because that man ran the gauntlet with tag partners. I mean, here he's with an experienced guy with a ton of time under his belt as a ringleader, and always been a great, really good strong worker in Randy Colley. But we also seen him having the team with Sting. And he was one of the guys who was really instrumental, and that's a guy they always, and especially in the WWF lore of Sting, he's a guy they don't give enough credit to, because he was one of the few. And Meltzer's always said it, that Eddie Gilbert was one of the only people when Sting stunk that said he's gonna be a good worker and be a star. And Eddie Gilbert was one of the first people who said it, and he helped develop Sting. They tagged together, were tag champions, worked with the Fantastics a lot, young in Sting's career. We saw Eddie Gilbert then move over with Rick Steiner for a while, and then he even teamed up with him when he got more seasoning in WCW in, like, 89. We see him here with the fake Russian as a tag partner for a while. John Tatum was a tag team partner for a while. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a guy who doesn't get enough credit as a tag worker. I mean, even him and his brother were a real fun tag team. Him and Ricky Morton as underneath babyfaces in Memphis was a heck of a tag team. He's really one of the best tag workers who no one ever puts up there as a tag worker. And I thought this match really highlighted his kind of brilliance as a tag team worker.
And I'm wondering, since you have it there, where does he rank on this in that heels book? Because
he's in there. They only rank the top 25.
Okay.
But he's in there as conniving heel.
I mean, because I'm sorry, that whole episode of Mid-South that ended with the Russian flag burial of Bill Watts.
Oh, great.
He's so fucking awesome in that. Based on that alone, I'm like, this guy's one of the best heels of all time.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, is that your favorite Eddie Gilbert angle?
Oh, fuck, yes.
Okay.
And I was cheering and jumping up and down in the room I was watching that, you know, live, well, you know, on TV at the time, because we got that Mid-South TV. Right. And while that crowd wanted to murder them, literally murder them, in the safety of my New Jersey bedroom, I was cheering Eddie Gilbert's cunning. Like, yeah, that's awesome. Fuck you, old man.
Yeah, he's had so many great ones. I mean, that was definitely up there. The This Is Your Life, Jerry Lawler was up there. My favorite was when he ran Jerry Lawler's ass over with a car. I'm sorry. That's my favorite Eddie Gilbert.
I love it, too. But as far as just pure, like, and worked that crowd, because they were all like, because he added in that great bit that he's like, look, I'm not going to stop managing the Blade Runners.
Yeah.
So he's saying, I'm not turning good guy here. I'm just realizing I should be hanging out with these fucking commies. I get it. And that's lent such an air of realism to it that when they turned around and fucked them, oh, that just like doubled the sting. And I was like, he's the best.
He really is. He's a great mind. And even in the Hills book, they talk about, which I get a kick out of. He was, you know, also a very, I mean, here he's, where the angle happened was he was the lead booker at the time of Mid-South. Of course, Bill Watts had the final say so. But at the time, Eddie Gilbert was booking back then. And he's booked Continental. He's booked Puerto Rico. He's booked Memphis. He's booked in a lot of different places. He was on the WCW booking committee when they brought Steamboat back. I mean, the guy's had a lot of success as being on a booking committee or being the lead booker. And ECW is another one. I mean, traditionally, eventually he'll burn his bridges or get burnout or something happens, loses a power play or what have you.
It's
or his demons.
He was just a case of a dude who's amazingly creative, self-destructive people.
Yeah.
Gee, you know?
Yeah.
We Jim see that Morrison. All forms yeah. of the arts, and yeah, Eddie Gilbert was one of them.
Yeah, Jim Morrison. Tons of, you know, I mean, that's another, you know.
You know what? You know what? I'd put the work of Eddie Gilbert above the work of Jim Morrison.
Wow.
The Doors is fucking overrated. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's kind of a Grateful Dead guy, Deadhead.
It's not like they were in competition. I'm just putting it out there.
I hear you. But one thing I got out of the Hillsville guy I always get a kick out of was a lot of times he used to, you know, he'd do fantasy booking as a kid, and sometimes he'd actually pull out find an old book, according to his buddy, and he'd like rework the angle so it would work. You know, so it fit. But he used an old angle he wrote as a little kid.
And really? That's tremendous.
Yeah, I always thought that was really cool. But here in the match, man, the Eddie Gilbert and the Nightmare are the tag champs here, and they have Humperdinck as their manager. And I thought both teams did a really good job here. The in-ring work had a real good ring psychology. And, of course, any match with Eddie Gilbert, you're going to expect pretty damn good ring psychology. And story was easy to follow. Gilbert and the Nightmare both bumped and stooged early for the Guerreros. The Guerreros got a really nice shine. First, they're working over the Nightmare's arm with some good arm work, and Gilbert gets in, and they really work over his arm. And then Chavo does this nasty-looking key lock in this. And of course, Chavo is pretty state-of-the-art worker at this point. And Hector's right on his heels, too. And, of course, the Nightmare uses some interference to turn the tide, which I always like. I like the heel to cheat to get the heat. It drives me nuts, even to this day, when the heels don't cheat to get the advantage, because I just hate it, because I'm such an old-school guy at heart. And then they get a good job working over Hector, and Chavo gets the hot tag, and he's running wild, and he hits a big move and has the visual pinfall. The heels distract the ref to allow Humperdinck to hit Chavo. The ref turned around just in time for the DQ. I thought it was like a legit 3.5, 3 and 3/4-star match. I really liked this. It was a great Southern tag. And the Guerreros actually here, in a lot of the footage we've seen, they have not stuck to a traditional Southern tag. But here, this was all Southern tag. So, of course, you know, Eddie Gilbert and the Nightmare, you know, are former Memphis mainstays are known probably mostly as known as Memphis workers. They take the Guerreros and go and fit the Guerreros into their formula, and they had a great match. I mean, I think Southern Tag Wrestling is the easiest formula to do, and it just blows my mind why some people just refuse to do it or fuck it up. And it's so simple to get heat and get it over, and here they did it fantastically, and they had a fantastic match.
I just want to mention before we move on, I love this line from Bosch, because the fans were he was explaining the fans cheering the Guerreros cheating, and if the ref was asking them and they're like no whatever, and he's like, it's not that the fans are dishonest, they're just being supportive.
Yep, I love that line too. I love Paul, how he tries to explain it. Johnny Logic's his way out of things. It's fantastic.
Why do you think I adore this man?
I know. I think he's like a. I think he. Speaking of family trees, there must have been. He must have fallen off the Bosch lineage somewhere.
I would be proud to, because I've made fun of him and I will continue to make fun of him. But holy fuck, if he can't find a way to make up a logic that's gonna work no matter fucking what, he does it. Because it's his goddamn promotion.
Yeah, he's fantastic at it.
That's smart, but I mean, boy, he can go into some real Byzantine logic, and I love it, because, you know, we have that in common.
Yeah, I like the announcer, even if it's bullshit, I like the announcer try to make something work, you know, and that's what Bosch does, and sometimes he'll make, you know, you know, give them lemons and they'll make lemonade out of it, and it works, you know?
Won't shit on anything.
Yeah.
And it's to hear. If you're going to figure out something to talk about or find some way to put this over, even if he fails, but he's not going to shit on it. And yeah. I love that.
And as a promoter, that makes sense, because he wants people to come back out the next week to come watch his product. And the next match we're going to look at is actually, it wasn't released this week. It was released a while ago, but it ties into our main event, which was, this was the Sheepherders versus the Bruz Brothers from a week ago, from January 24th, 1986. And it was pretty much just a straight up angle to set up this Chicago street fight behind the, between the Sheepherders and the Bruz Brothers. But I thought this was a great hardcore angle that puts heat on the feud. What do you think of the angle? Or can you explain it?
I'm trying to remember because I'm looking down at my notes and I just have the match between the Sheepherders and the Bruz Brothers.
Okay, pretty much so, the Sheepherders debut. This is the Sheepherders debut in Houston.
Okay.
So they need to kind of, they want to get them over strong right away. And what a way to get the heel team over. They get them over as dangerous. They pretty much jump the faces right at Jump Street and beat the living crap out of the Bruz Brothers. They're both busted open. They end up getting DQ'd by beating the living shit out of them, and they leave the faces a bloody mess, and it had a real gritty and violent feel to it. It just got the angle going right off the bat. And
I must have missed that because all I got was their match that they had with, I guess, like what they called a New Zealand street fight or something.
Yes, I you must have misunderstood my notes. This happened months ago. This match aired, and I just wanted to do it to give the feud a little bit more juice to it. The match a little bit more juice to explain to it.
Really?
Yeah.
No, please. I'm gonna go back and watch it because I love this.
Yeah, it was like a 3-minute angle. I mean, it was booked as a match, but it was pretty much an angle to set up next week. Where people are coming to pay to see the Bruz Brothers. And
gotcha.
And this is a different Bruz Brothers team than we're used to from Memphis. Memphis was Austin and Porkchop Cash. For Porkchop Cash is no more. So we had have a new Bruz Brother in the thing. But it still works. And it was just kind of funny. In Houston, we've seen the two different... Originally, we have a match with the Midnight Express years ago. Where it was originally supposed to be the Bruz Brothers. And I think it was Norvell Austin. Couldn't make it or something happened. And Bill Dundee stepped in. And so it was Dundee and Porkchop Cash as the Bruz Brothers. And now here we have a new Bruz Brother.
That's hilarious.
Forming the Bruz Brothers. And he looks a little bit, if he hits the gimmick a little bit better than Bill Dundee. And at this point, we'll take a break. And we'll come right back with the main event for the evening.
PWO PTBN feed has changed its name. Now it will be known simply as Pro Wrestling Only. So it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more. Including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
So now we are back and we're like a week later. Now it's January 31st, 1986, and we get this match between the Sheepherders and the Bruz Brothers, which is a Chicago street fight.
That was a Chicago street fight, of course.
And
Bruz Brothers.
This is, the heat here is absolutely insane. I mean, I think part of it is, it's off the hot angle. The Bruz Brothers are a really fun gimmick to get behind.
Mm-hmm.
On top of it, Houston, Texas, I think it might be one of, if not the most patriotic city in the United States. I'm sure the Sheepherders are from New Zealand. But, I mean, we've seen them on these heels. I mean, they take a lot of pride in, I mean, they're right down the street from NASA. They have a lot of pride. I mean, they remember the Alamo.
How dare you, sir? being a Kentucky man, take offense at your assertion that you're more patriotic than our fair bluegrass state.
And people don't remember, we had in junior high, we had to take a class called Texas History, so we take a lot of pride in Texas. That's something they indoctrinate you as a young age.
Wow,
I remember I moved from St. Louis to Texas in like I think it was the fifth grade, and I remember vividly that I had to sign up for Texas History. My parents could not freaking believe I was taking Texas History class. I've never heard of anything else teaching. I mean, when you were in Jersey, was there a New Jersey history class?
No, not at all. Outside of going to class trips, you went to the most local historical place that they could afford to take you. But no. Yes.
And mind you, I've probably seen the Alamo more than most anybody, except for people in Texas. I've seen the Alamo movie probably more than anybody, because every substitute teacher would come in and like, oh, hey, we'll watch the Alamo. That was like the Texas history standby of substitute teachers.
No, because see, that's because you got brainwashed in that first class. They know how to keep you monsters under control is by showing you the Alamo, and you're all focused on it because you're all obsessed with the Alamo.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. I mean, on our buddy Will's journey, I'm sure he lived in San Antonio. That guy probably has like 2,000 pictures of him in the Alamo.
So you were a St. Louis boy, and they stuck you in the mind control class. That's hilarious.
Yeah, that's right. We learned that the Ark, the St. Louis Arch, isn't as important as the Alamo.
How many people died fighting for that, huh?
Exactly. But here, back to the match, man. The heat here was
off the charts.
Off the charts. It wasn't like this incredible match, but the crowd made it. So it worked for me perfectly. I thought this was a decent brawl. Made all the ball better by this incredible crowd heat. I really can't put over how much heat the Sheepherders generated here. They got so much. It was clearly they wanted to kill. And this is a Southern crowd, and they're behind 100% behind the African-American baby faces, okay? Southern, let me put it this, Houston, they're not, I mean, it's not like Podunk where Jim Cornette, like in Tennessee and small towns they ran, or in Louisiana. This is a big town, but there was definitely it's still a Southern town who did in 1986 who were not embracing their African-American heroes. But JYD definitely was a big charge of changing that tradition. Even Butch Reed, they got over huge here. And now the Bruise Brothers and Sheepherders, the heat they got. I mean, honestly, this was freaking palpable. I mean, it was just white hot. It was white hot where wrestlers would kill to get this type of heat.
It describes the crowd white.
Yeah. But it was just funny. Houston was always an ethnic crowd. There was African Americans, a ton of Hispanics, a ton of whites.
I get it.
But I got to say, for crowd heat, the match gets 5 stars. For work,
Jesus Christ, it's amazing. Yeah, 8.
For work, yeah. For work, I give it 2 stars, and I'll go 3.25 on the match. I had to compare them because, I mean, the bottom line, your job as a wrestler, as a heel, is to get heat. And right there, that would make the Sheepherders the greatest workers of all time because this was so heated. It was just a fun kick brawl. Yeah. It was just what you need to do. There was no headlocks, no spinning toe holds, no figure fours. It was all punch, kick, eye gouge. I mean, they worked it how they needed to. It wasn't all – they didn't it was short and sweet. They didn't rewrite the textbook on how to do a brawl. They just did what they needed to do, and it was a blood affair and super heated. And gosh, what a way. I mean people would probably, who were there live, were probably talking about it to this day, because it was how it was a chaotic brawl that just was made so much better by the crowd. And yeah. And I'm a firm believer in crowd reaction to matches. If you're doing whatever in a vacuum and no one's responding, then you're not working the right match for that crowd. I mean, sure it helps when you're over, but geez, the Sheepers have just been here for 1 week and they generated this heat. Sure, they had a history in San Antonio for Joe Blanchard's Southwest Championship Wrestling. They were big in '83 and '84 there, or left in early '84. I mean, but that was still at least a year and a half, 2 years ago, and they're debuting here in Houston, and they're white hot heels.
Yeah. And they also had the advantage of a magazine reputation.
That too. You're right. Good point. What were your thoughts here on the heat and the match? Because I mean, the heat is what I think is the match.
It's amazing.
Itself.
It's incredible. There's not much else I can say about it because it's just insane. Now, I will mention, somewhere near like the hard camera mic were some dudes who were goofing on the match when it became time for like the actual very few times where there was a headlock or anything, and it looked kind of phony, you know, and these, I call them hillbilly smart fans who'd be goofing on it. Like, you always, I remember those kinds of guys. Oh, look at that, man. That's so phony. And they were that and only popped up every now and then. And to me, that gave me the full ambiance of being in that crowd because everything else was so hot and that came up. And us was, the Sheepherders, yes, amazing heat machines. I got to talk about the Bruise Brothers. Speaking of magazine reputations, when I first saw that there was a team called the Bruise Brothers, I immediately went, I love it. I want to see these guys because I was such a Blues Brothers mega geek fan as a kid. And then into wrestling, I'm like, that's such a great idea, you know. And I love the fact that they were black, and it says, oh, they're bad guys. And then you see them as good guys, and they're, and here's the thing, yeah, is it shucking and jiving a little bit? Yeah, yeah, it is. You know, that's what that was part of wrestling at the time. But they were big and they were bad, and that same, they even had the briefcase.
Yeah.
You know, like Elwood had the fucking briefcase and Soul Man hits. And then there's, again, not a lot of music for these guys at this time. Fucking Soul Man hits. They dance down to the fucking ring. Yeah. And yeah, they're like these huge fucking monsters. And it's awesome that you're having fun, but they look like they're going to fuck somebody up.
And it's actually a gimmick. You feel like, yeah, you could get over in today's wrestling, too.
Maybe in the indies, but it's, you know, who's in it? It's just like they made Blues Brothers 2000, and that movie stunk. You know,
I understand.
You know, but this was just this giant fucking brawl, and I wrote down that the Bruise Brothers were being used as the Black Fantastics.
It's funny.
Everyone, they had the fucking the jackets and the ties and the hats and the sunglasses.
Yeah, that's true.
But far better dancers.
Yeah,
and
they couldn't. They were the Fantastics actually kissed the ladies. I didn't see the Bruise Brothers kiss.
Bill Watts and Paul Bosch are gonna let those two motherfuckers run around kissing a bunch of white women? What, no. Are you mad?
No,
that wasn't gonna happen. I wish. They wouldn't be baby faces.
Yeah, they'd be heels.
But and then they did a little mic work to even hype the crowd up a little bit more.
Yeah.
After the entrances and everyone's going ape shit, and then they start doing fucking mic work. Boom, boom, boom. The place, goddamn, was like a tinderbox. Boom, ready to go off. It did go off. You can't hate this. Who gives a shit about work rate? This is amazing.
Yeah. One of my favorite lines is actually Matt D, which was talking about this match. And he said, the comeback here, as fleeting as it was, had to be the best moment of Mad Dog Boyd's life with the crowd getting behind him like that. Because honestly, I can't remember any other Mad Dog Boyd except for the Bruise Brother. I don't think he, if he did, they never repackaged him into another successful gimmick. I just loved it. And this, yeah, the heat here.
Oh. That was his one shot because, you know, hey, kid, the other Bruise Brother, he didn't make it. Tonight, you're a Bruise Brother.
You fit the jacket like Peter Brady, or no, Greg Brady in the Brady Bunch when he was Johnny Bravo or whatever.
I think it was a little bit more than fit the jacket, but, you know. Let's face it, they looked at it and was like, yeah, you're close enough for this crowd.
Yeah, man. God.
And he was awesome. And he was so fired up, you know, with that little comeback. That's so true. Yep. I enjoyed this immensely. So much fun.
So much fun. Man, that was another week of NWA On Demand releases. It ran the gauntlet from squash matches to Stinker to making a really super fun Southern tag to an epic brawl that was like about as heated as a match we've seen so far on here, honestly. And
see, and that's, you know, that's the cunning of the spoiler, because he's like, oh, this service, NWA On Demand, constantly giving you the best matches you've ever seen. I'm going to spoil it. Spoiler strikes again.
And I mean, it's just, it's funny though that the bushwhackers, the sheep herders, are actually had got more heat than I think any other, like the Russians or the Bolsheviks or the Japanese. I really think the sheep herders got it's unreal. You know,
And you know, this is also on a more quote unquote serious note about this shit. For everyone who, there's been this like blowback amongst from younger fans when you keep telling them that, you know, the Bushwhackers, when they were the sheep herders, man, they were fucking good. And like, there's only a handful of things out there, and people just saw a match and go, yeah, I don't think so. You old people are just remembering it wrong. And we're like, no, we're not.
It's true.
This is the proof. This shit's the proof, because fuck you if anyone could come out and get that kind of heat.
Yeah, the one thing I always get a kick out of, like, for us, when they became the Bushwhackers, it was a jarring, complete 360, right? Like, you would never believe the sheep herders would be these lovable baby faces.
I actually kind of heard about it, and then I saw it, like, briefly. I was like, ugh. But I got it. Even then, I'm like, I get it. You know, the end of the career. Even then, I was old enough to get, oh, you guys get to finally get make big money and not have to roll around in barbed wire. I get it.
I totally get it. But well, my point is though, for us, that was like a complete 360, right?
Oh,
now the people who were exposed to the Bushwhackers and now see like something like this. I mean, that's a total 360 to them, which is just. Fantastic from both sides of the coin. You can see it on both sides. Yeah.
But for them, that's a very more positive thing. It's like this thing you thought sucked. Hey, check this out. Oh, shit. It's always more fun to discover something good. You know, for us, it's, you know, match-wise, it's a regression. Like, yeah, you know, fucking Bushwhackers, I don't give a shit.
Yeah, I'll take the foot sweep.
I'll take this.
Yeah, I'm no doubt. And, but it was cool. They got their moment in the WWE Hall of Fame. And I thought they had a great speech, and they
were hilarious.
And the fans still responded to them, you know, which I loved. How it was such a memorable gimmick, and definitely very PG-13-esque.
They did the George the Animal Steel gimmick with them, basically.
Yep.
It worked.
And it worked.
Everyone remembers those guys.
Yeah, man. Another great week of NWA On Demand. Johnny, you got anything to plug?
No, not really. Right now, we're good.
Okay. Well, follow me at Titans O Wrestling. We also just dropped today a Titans special, Christmas special episode-esque, where we talk about some of the best talkers of the 70s. So if you haven't followed that show, check it out, man. It's actually our flagship, I would call.
Yeah, so I should have remembered to plug that. I was being generous and just tossing you that line.
Well, I appreciate that, Johnny.
I'm a good guy.
You know,
I can't believe I forgot that.
It's all good, all good. If you have time, check that one out. That one just dropped, and this one will be dropping eventually. And have a good night, folks, and keep on watching. NWA On Demand, buy it, get the first week free.
So I pout like a grown jerk, wishing all I had to do now was finish homework. It's true, you don't realize really what you got till it's gone, and I'm not gonna sing another sad song. But sometimes I do sit and reminisce and think about the years I was raised.
Back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore. But some days I sit and wish I was a kid again. Back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore. But some days I sit and wish I was a kid.
And everybody
say, I remember way back when.
And everybody say,
I remember way back when.
What?
Back in the days,
when.